This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The Prime Minister of New Zealand is calling it quits.
I know there will be much discussion in the aftermath of this decision as to what the so-called real reason was.
Jacinda Ardern says don't read into it. She's just burned out. Also today, a Canadian government agency has a message for alcohol drinkers, cut way back. Could be hard. There have been lots of mixed messages.
I was very honest with how much I was drinking, and my family doctor was like, no, you're good. And I'm like, are you sure? Because I've been drinking consistently.
Plus, scandal behind the cue balls.
If you looked at the newspaper headlines in the UK today, they would say things like snooker reeling, dark day for snooker, that kind of thing.
Snooker and the pros who are behaving badly, all that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for being with us today. Ukraine needs tanks. That is the message the government in Kyiv has been sending to the U.S. and European allies. Today, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin is in Berlin, aiming to convince Germany's government to send Leopard 2 tanks to Ukraine. His message came with thanks for what Germany has done so far in the war.
But throughout the crisis caused by Russia's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine, Germany has remained a true friend of the United States and a staunch defender of our allies.
Germany, however, is hesitant to take the additional step of sending its tanks to Ukraine. This will be a focal point tomorrow when Secretary Austin hosts a meeting in Germany about future military support that Western allies may give Ukraine. This morning we spoke with retired Admiral James Stavridis. He's a former NATO Supreme Ally Commander, and asked him what impact tanks would have on Ukraine's ability to fight Russia right now.
Huge impact for several reasons. First of all, the Russian tanks and armored personnel carriers, many thousands probably, were destroyed. So Russia is tank and armored personnel carrier poor at the moment. Number two, if Russia mounts a spring offensive using these newly mobilized foot soldiers, infantry, those are very juicy targets for tanks and armored personnel carriers.
So Germany is facing a lot of pressure this week to send tanks to Ukraine. Why is the German-made Leopard tank especially wanted in Ukraine?
First, because it's a pretty heavy tank. It's not quite as big as the Abrams tank. The Leopard is a big, strong, tough tank, but it's relatively simple to operate compared to, for example, an Abrams. And most importantly, it's widely distributed across the NATO nations. Germany has exported many of these to the Baltic states, to many former Warsaw Pact countries. So there's a lot of expertise, training, a lot of inventory, and therefore they are highly desired by the Ukrainians. They're in theater, they're ready to go, not a lot of training required.
Well, yesterday, German officials said they won't send Leopard tanks unless the U.S. sends Abrams. What do you make of that?
I think it's part of an ongoing conversation. And at the end of the day, I would guess that our German colleagues will say, you know, we would like to put the Leopards out there. And part of this, by the way, is for the Germans to give permission to the other European nations who hold these Leopard tanks to give them, as well as some German Leopards. I think that the Germans ultimately will acquiesce in a deal where we, the U.S. and the Canadians, put a large number of armored personnel carriers. They provide the tanks. That's a pretty good deal.
Well, the U.S. is providing Ukraine with other heavy-duty weapons of war. Why is the U.S. hesitant to provide tanks?
What has held us back, not only not an obvious military need, which is emerging now, but secondly, we have always in this conflict tried to use the minimal amount of weapon systems so that we could avoid escalating the war and leading to a direct conflict between NATO and Russia. But I think we've hit the point now where the tanks are a necessity given where we are in the battle.
Yeah, so why would a tank specifically imply a greater involvement in the war than, say, the Patriot missile system?
Marco, I don't think it does. And this has been, I think, a kind of a false assumption out of the West. It was taken out of an abundance of caution. I understand that. I think it made a higher degree of sense, say, 10, 11 months ago, when you could have envisioned an outcome where Putin got knocked back, then we had a negotiation, we could avoid an escalation. I think we're past that point now, unfortunately. And therefore, yeah, Patriots, yeah, tanks, I would say, yeah, fighter aircraft. That's the next conversation that's going to happen.
Can you talk more about that? I mean, that seems a really deep commitment in this war.
We are at the point where the Western side needs to say to itself, are we going to give the Ukrainians control over their skies? And to do that, we've already provided surface-to-air missiles. We provided the Patriot batteries. We provided drones. The one big thing we haven't given them is combat aircraft. And by providing them, say, MiG-29s, which the Poles own and operate and are willing to give to the Ukrainians who've been trained in flying those specific airframes, we should do that, in my view, because that will further shut down Vladimir Putin's options. Right now, he's using air control in order to strike Ukrainian targets and all over Ukraine, and there were crimes against the electric grid, the water supplies, against civilians in apartment buildings. Aircraft could help stop that. We had to provide them those aircraft.
But, I mean, any of these options, starting with a tank deal, I mean, would you see that as another step closer to direct war between Russia and NATO?
No, I don't think it significantly elevates the chances, because you still don't have NATO soldiers, sailors, airmen actually conducting the combat. These are still Ukrainians conducting the combat. And as you postulated a moment ago, in the end, giving a Ukrainian a rifle is merely a matter of degree in how you're attacking Russian forces than giving them a Patriot missile or a tank. So I think the earlier ideas of doing this in a very measured, incremental way, I think that's fading as we look at Russian intransigence, Russian war crimes. Very clear intent of Vladimir Putin to continue to prosecute this unjust war. And don't forget that Putin could stop this tomorrow. It's this idea that somehow we're provoking Russia, which is kind of magical thinking. It's Putin that's invaded here. We need to give the Ukrainians what they need to stop him.
So, Admiral, as you said, the German Leopard tank doesn't require a lot of training. It's already in theater. If a deal is struck, some kind of agreement between Germany and the U.S. and Ukraine, how soon could you see delivery of these tanks, deployment into the battlefield?
Days, and certainly within weeks. This is primed, ready to go. And by the way, my contacts in European militaries, there's a great deal of enthusiasm for getting these weapons in the hands of the Ukrainians. It's a political decision that needs to be made.
I mean, in a modern war where we've seen drones play such a key role, remotely operated, does it surprise you the historical piece of equipment like a tank is so important right now?
It doesn't surprise me. And the logical question would be, well, what happened to all of those Russian tanks a year ago? Because a lot of them were destroyed by drones. That's why this marriage of an old weapon, the tank, with these new weapons, the drones, I think is going to be very powerful against the Russians.
Admiral James Stavridis is a retired Navy admiral and the former NATO Supreme Allied Commander. Thank you very much for being with us for this.
Thank you very much.
The news from New Zealand caught a lot of people off guard. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said she's stepping down. Ardern had become something of a global icon for her actions protecting New Zealand in the early days of the pandemic, not to mention her leadership in other areas. Ardern's reason for stepping down, something many of us can probably relate to. She said she no longer has enough in the tank.
I know there will be much discussion in the aftermath of this decision as to what the so-called real reason was. I can tell you that what I'm sharing today is it. The only interesting angle that you will find is that after going on 6 years of some big challenges, I am human.
For more on this, we turn to the world's Sarah Birnbaum.
To be fair, Ardern has good reason to be exhausted. In her 5.5 years in office, she's gone from one crisis to the next. There was the Christchurch terror attack in 2019, when a gunman opened fire at two mosques, murdering 51 people.
This is and will be one of New Zealand's darkest days.
Ardern comforted mourners and families of victims following the attacks. She wore a hijab as she met with members of the Muslim community and declared that the whole country was united in grief. But there were more dark days to come. 9 months later, a volcano erupted on White Island as a group of travelers scrambled for safety.
Tonight, a terrifying escape for tourists fleeing this massive volcanic eruption that came close to killing them.
The disaster ended up killing 21 people and left dozens more with terrible burns. Then, of course, in 2020 came the pandemic. Ardern gave daily press briefings with the country's Director General of Health.
Public health officials have been working at pace this afternoon to gather information on the case and their movements, and I will pass to Dr. Bloomfield shortly to set out the facts as we currently know them.
She imposed strict lockdowns and vaccine mandates on New Zealanders and succeeded in keeping the virus at bay. That won Ardern applause from around the world. And Pete McKenzie says it paid off at home, too. He's a New Zealand journalist focused on politics.
Ardern's COVID response helped her win the largest electoral victory in the modern era of New Zealand politics. No previous politician in recent decades had ever won their party an outright majority in parliament.
More recently, though, the Prime Minister's popularity in New Zealand has been plummeting, due in no small part to inflation and an ailing economy. On top of that, McKenzie says, Ardern became the target of anti-vaxxers and the far right.
Following the pandemic, we've seen this massive uptick in hostility and partisanship in New Zealand, that kind of conspiracism and anger of a very small fraction of New Zealand society who have been radicalized by kind of American-style disinformation.
And last year, when protesters occupied parliament grounds, they called for Ardern's execution. Kate Hanna monitors online extremism with the Disinformation Project based in New Zealand. She says the level of violent online rhetoric against the prime minister has risen exponentially since the start of the pandemic.
So extreme misogyny, extremely vulgar and violative language, imagery and memes, which are horrific and violent, violent death threats posted online publicly, and also violent death threats posted directly to the Prime Minister herself.
Hannah says the stuff she sees every day is so vulgar and scary that she won't even describe it on the radio. She says it's no surprise the Prime Minister decided to resign. That kind of vitriol takes a toll. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
It's been a brutal winter in Afghanistan, and the weather is making the country's humanitarian crisis worse. The Taliban government said today that at least 78 people have died because of freezing temperatures across Afghanistan, and that more than 1 million people across the country are suffering in the harsh conditions. A spokesperson for the Taliban also said a staggering 75,000 livestock had died from the cold. Forecasts indicate temperatures dropping as low as negative 31 degrees Fahrenheit across parts of the country this weekend. Humanitarian aid groups are providing help to families, including heating, cash for fuel, and warm clothes. But UN officials say that distributing that aid has been severely impacted by the ban on women working with NGOs. In a separate statement today, the Taliban ordered relevant authorities and government officials to help affected families. Coming up on the show, Canada revises its advice on how much alcohol is too much. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We've been hearing a lot about a new report that suggests that even small amounts of alcohol have negative health consequences. Canada is acting on this. Drink less is the new recommendation from a Canadian agency that sets national standards for alcohol consumption. In line with the research, they say it's all about better health. But as Anita Elash reports from Toronto, Canadian health officials are likely to face an uphill battle in trying to get people to cut back.
On a sunny Sunday afternoon, this brew pub is one of the hottest spots in Toronto's trendy West End. A young couple plays hide-and-seek with their toddler. Almost everyone has a dog. Eddie Hui is here with one of his best friends. He's enjoying his third pint today.
If I say anything stupid, because I'm a little bit tipsy, I don't...
For Hui, having a few drinks at the local pub is a big part of his social life.
I think it's a habit thing where it's like, okay, I'm stressed, I should have a beer. I go out, I see friends, I should have a beer. Oh, it's a nice day, I should have a beer.
Hui figures he drinks around 14 pints of beer a week. That was considered safe under the old Canadian guidelines. Under the new guidelines, he's firmly in the danger zone. Dr. Donald Budd is an addiction specialist and co-chair of the committee that wrote the new recommendations.
The notion that alcohol is good for the heart is false. And the notion that alcohol is good for one's health and well-being is false.
Alcohol is considered a class one carcinogen, just like tobacco and asbestos. Butt says there's growing evidence that alcoholic beverages cause at least seven types of cancer.
Including breast cancer, colon rectal cancer, liver cancer, GI cancers including the mouth and the oropharynx, the larynx, and so on.
The report says one or two standard drinks a week is probably okay health-wise. 3 to 6 standard drinks a week, and your risk of developing cancers such as colon and breast cancer starts to rise. Anything more than 6 per week means a substantially higher risk of heart disease and stroke. But says it's time for Canadians to reflect on how much they drink and why.
So we need to be rethinking our relationship with alcohol. How do we use it? Why do we use it in the way that we do?
The authors of the report are pushing for mandatory warning labels, spelling out how much alcohol is in a drink and what the health risks are. Addiction specialist Dr. Jennifer Wyman says that information will be helpful.
It's not criticizing anyone else, but it's another one of those positive choices that people make for their health.
But for many customers at the brew pub, cutting back is going to be a tough sell. Marissa Gatto is a newly graduated beer sommelier. She's enjoying one of the house specialties, a winter spiced blonde.
I'm getting notes of pears, apples, cinnamon. So what I get out of it is a party in my mouth.
Gatto says she's comfortable with the amount she drinks now and would never drink and drive. She notes that in Canada, it's the government that regulates and sells alcohol.
So they can recommend whatever they want. They're still going to sell it to me.
Eddie Hui, who's now on his fourth pint, says he's talked to his doctor about cutting back.
I was very honest with how much I was drinking, and my family doctor was like, no, you're good. And I'm like, are you sure? Because I've been drinking, consistently. for a very long time. And he's like, no, your liver's good.
Hui says he would drink less only if beer prices doubled. But even with runaway inflation, that's not likely to happen. For The World, I'm Anita Elash in Toronto.
Scandal at the highest levels of professional snooker. For those of you who have no idea what that means, snooker is a game similar to pool or billiards. It's played with 22 balls on the table and is popular in the UK and China, among other places. The news from the world of snooker is this. 10 professional players from China are being charged with match fixing. One of them is a Masters champion. Frank Keough is all across the story. He's a senior journalist with BBC Sports. So set this up for us, Frank. Tell us exactly what happened here.
Right, so I understand, Marco, that snooker's not that well known with everybody in the States. It's a big sport in the United Kingdom, and increasingly it's a big sport in China as well. That's a really big market for it. It's emerged in the last few months that the snooker authorities were having an investigation following some information they received about what appeared to be suspicious betting patterns on matches. As a result of that, they suspended one player. And at that time, it seemed like it was a fairly run-of-the-mill thing. But as the investigation progressed, more players were suspended. And we now have a situation where there are 10 players, all from China, and they've all been charged with some kind of match-fixing offence.
And in the world of snooker, how significant is this news?
Well, if you looked at the newspaper headlines in the UK today, they would say things like snooker reeling, dark day for snooker, that kind of thing. So it's a really big thing. And to put it in context, there's quite a big tournament taking place at the moment. And when the broadcaster began their TV coverage yesterday, the first 10 minutes didn't talk about that tournament at all. It was all about the news of these charges.
So, Frank, what is snooker? Just like the basics of how it's played, starting with the number of balls, 22 versus 15 in billiards, right?
I suppose the best way of explaining it is it's kind of a more complex version of pool. So pool would be played on tables that are about maybe 8 foot, 2.5 meters long, where snooker would be 12 foot, 3.5 meters long. There's more balls. It takes more time.
So tell us about the players involved in the scandal. All 10 are Chinese. What else do we know about them?
Yes. Now, the two probably most well-known players who have been suspended and charged are Yan Bingtao. Now, he was the first snooker player born in the year 2000 to turn professional. Shows how young he is. And then there is another well-known player who won the Masters tournament, which is a really big tournament, one of probably the big three tournaments in the calendar, really. And then Zhao Xingtong, who won the 2021 UK Championship, he's also been charged. So they would be among the top 16 players in the world.
So, I mean, fixing matches in snooker, what's the motivation?
Right, well, that's a good point. So we sometimes hear about corruption in sport, people trying to cheat to gain an advantage. So there might be doping to enhance performance. Well, as in this case, they're actually trying to perform less well because they're looking to lose matches. And the reason they do that is in the modern betting markets, as well as being able to back players to win a match, you can back players to lose a match. So if you know that a player is likely to lose the match, you can profit by backing that player to lose.
What's next for these players? Could they face criminal charges in China? Or are they certain to go back to China?
It's likely that they will go back to China if they're found guilty, and then it's up in the air as to whether there will be a criminal investigation. There isn't one at the moment. It may be decided that that's enough if they're found guilty and given bans. But the World Snooker chairman, Jason Ferguson, has said that it's open to the Chinese authorities to open an investigation if they want to down the line.
Frank Keough is a senior journalist with BBC Sports. Frank, thank you very much for taking the time to unpack all the snooker news for us. Really appreciate it.
No problem.
More news and stories from around the globe are still coming your way just ahead. You're listening to The World. A list of sacred spaces in New York City might have included Rockefeller Center. An unfinished plan included a chapel for the top floor. It was never built.
But this idea that there's a chapel right at the top of this like real estate venture is very interesting.
In a very secular city, a new exhibit takes us inside the lives of faithful New Yorkers. Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. It may be close to hyperbole to say this, but not too far off the mark. The entire nation of France is on strike. A general strike spread across France today. Now, I know you might be thinking, aren't the French always striking something? Today's strikes, though, are huge, even by French standards. The thing that has people so riled up, raising France's retirement age. Joining me now from Marseille is Vincent Martigny. He's a professor of politics at the University of Nice. Can you give us a sense, Vincent, first of all, just how big this strike is today? What kind of workers walked off the job?
It probably is about the biggest strike in France in the last 10 years. I think you have to go back to the year 2010 to see a strike to this importance. Train drivers, teachers, bus drivers, all kinds of professions, hospitals have been on strike. Of course, professors at university, professors in secondary schools, like a whole set of French people have decided to strike today.
So classes are canceled at universities and like buses, are they running?
No, they're not really running. I mean, you have part of it is running, but say it's very limited. If you want to travel today, it's going to be very difficult in France because I think it's only one train out of five that is circulating. And it depends. Some lines are almost closed. In Paris, you can't even take the tube because most of it is closed. And in the street, you would find probably about 1 million people altogether, which is on a population of 68 million might sound not very much, but in fact, it's quite big.
It's the pension issue that's really at the center of this, that triggered this. I mean, the French government has proposed raising the retirement age from 62 to 64. Why is that?
Well, the argument of the government is that there will be more and more elderly people in the future, and that in a way, the financing of this pension scheme is impossible to imagine in the next few years. There are going to be less and less people working, more and more people benefiting from these pensions for a longer time than before, because also the age expectancy is higher than in the past. The argument of the government is an argument based on economy, but there's another also argument saying that until now, you have a certain number of special pension plans. Depending on the job that you do, what the government wants to do is a universal pension scheme that would be the same for everyone. And to that, many workers say, well, but all the jobs are not as difficult. So some are more arduous than others. And this arduousness should be taken into account in the calculation of the pension.
It makes me wonder, though, why the financing of France's pension system is seemingly in crisis to begin with. Is it bad economic planning in Paris?
I think just for you to understand, the spending of pensions is about 300 billion euros per year. It amounts for about 13% of national income. So that's a huge, huge amount of money. And in a way, even there's been anticipation of the fact that the population was getting older, like everywhere in most liberal democracies, a large majority of the population refuses to reform a very generous pension scheme in France, which is a pension that is far more generous than other countries like the US, for example, in which basically if you are a civil servant or if you're working at a company and you've been working all your life, you can retire quite early. Until today was between 60 and 62, and the conditions are rather good for a large part of the population. So in a way, the reason why we are in this situation is not that we didn't really anticipate, but it was very politically costly to make this reform.
Now, our American listeners, for whom retirement is defined at 67 by the Social Security Administration, I should add that many Americans work well past 67 because, well, really, they don't have a choice. 64 even may seem like a luxury, a gift. But for the French, retiring at 62 has a long history, right? And is a cherished part of the culture.
Yeah, it's the thing. I mean, in the history of the French left, for example, and the fight for civil rights, the issue of retiring at 60 was a very important objective. And even for the left today, many people for left-wing parties ask that retirement legal age would be going down to 60 and not 62. So you could see that we're departing from a point in which the legal age of retirement is a pivotal point or a symbolic dimension in the political mind of people. It means a society that is where workers are protected and can live early to enjoy their retirement.
Back to today, Vincent, do we know what kind of results the strikes are having yet, or is it too early to say?
It's a bit too early to say, I think. I mean, what is at risk for the marchers is that if their number is not strong enough, if their capacity of blockage of the country is not big enough, right, then the government will think that these trade unions are not really influential anymore. And many people have a lot to lose. The government has a lot to lose. Also, the trade unions call for another strike, probably next Thursday. We could be entering a cycle of protests. I think the real failure for Macron would be the rise of a massive social movement that would last, like the Yellow Jacket in 2018. That's what Macron wants to avoid at any cost.
Is it hard, Vincent, for people in their 60s or older to find work in France? I mean, is there workplace bias against older workers?
But that's another issue. Yes, it is very hard. I mean, after 55, if you're on the dole, if you don't have a job, if you're unemployed, it's very hard to find a job. It's also a country in which the number of years, of good years for the job market is quite limited. I mean, you enter the job market when you may be 25, and then you're in your full capacity of working until your 50s. But then after that, it's very hard if you lose your job to find another one.
Vincent Martini is a professor of politics at the University of Nice. Vincent, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much indeed.
Worldwide, nearly 240 million children with disabilities face challenges getting access to basic needs. That includes access to adequate nutrition, health care, and education. In many parts of Africa, children with special needs are hidden away at home. But there are efforts to flip the script. From Accra, Ghana, Ridwan Karim Dini Osman reports on efforts to push for better inclusion of children with special needs.
At a local clinic in Accra, Mami Apia sits on a blue bench with her three-year-old baby beside her. When she was pregnant, she was excited and prayed for a healthy baby. However, her joy was cut short after she started noticing something unusual about her child a few weeks after his birth.
Because he couldn't even suckle. He had breathing issues. He was spirit at every feed.
Doctors later diagnosed that her son had cerebral palsy, a condition that affects a child's brain, movement, and muscle posture or tone.
Life has been so difficult. First, I had depressions, and I didn't even know how I was going to handle a brain-damaged boy.
Mami Apia has since moved past her grief and is now seeking help for her child.
Currently, we are doing therapies. So we do eye therapy, physiotherapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, and some medication. We can't even afford it, so we do once a week.
Brain developmental disorders are hardly talked about in Ghana. And experts say it is one of the most neglected health issues in the West African country. On the other side of the city, 50-year-old Mary Kofor is determined to change the narrative. Her daughter is autistic, but Kofor says she was in denial for 7 years after receiving the diagnosis.
Sometimes I see myself as somebody who gave birth the past 20 years and the child never grows. So I have a 20-year-old girl who needs 24/7 support, from bathing to eating to directing her on what to do.
Ghana's 2016 inclusive education policy seeks to increase access for children with special needs in public schools. However, the government has yet to fully implement it. So, parents of children with special needs have to enroll their children in centers which cost more than $3,000 a year, something many parents cannot afford. Kofor has established this center to accommodate more children at a highly subsidized fee. Here, instructors use everyday routines as opportunities for children to learn different communication and social interaction skills. Ekuya Amoakuyabua has been working here since 2018.
So when they come in the morning, we have circle time like what schools do, and then they break out into their therapy sessions with their speech therapists, occupational therapists, behavior therapists.
The majority of the children here have autism, while some have Down syndrome or are undiagnosed. In the young adult section, some of the children who were brought in with communication challenges are now seeing improvements, like 13-year-old Joseph Hammond, who has Down syndrome. He tells me what he's been learning in science.
In science, we learned water, uses of water. I use water to drink. He use water to bath. He use water to cook.
Mary Kofor wants to demystify autism, which is perceived as a curse or witchcraft in many Ghanaian societies. She's already seen a change in mindset among a lot of Ghanaian parents and caregivers.
The fact that, for once, parents are feeling confident to identify with somebody who is on the same road with them.
But she is not alone in the movement to make the world a better place for children with special needs. Model and actress Afi Antonio is the brain behind Mr. and Miss Autism Ghana, a pageant aimed at promoting social inclusion for persons with developmental disorders.
Mr. and Miss Autism, where we can showcase these children in terms of what they can do, model, you know, so that society can also know that, oh, these children can also do all these things.
She believes the pageant will also help some of the children secure their livelihoods through ambassadorial contracts with local and international brands.
Because I have a feeling that this will open doors for other children, and it would also spread the advocacy on autism to take it far.
For Afi Antonio and Mary Kofor, advancing the rights of those with special needs and ensuring their full participation and inclusion in society can contribute to a future of dignity and opportunity. For the world, I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
Where is the cultural center of America? A lot of people would argue New York City. A new museum exhibit there takes visitors inside New York culture, inside one part of it that's not typically associated with the city. We sent the world Sarah Hassan to check it out.
Probably the first thing that comes to mind when people think about New York City? Broadway musicals.
Softly, deftly, music shall caress you.
Beyond show business, there's Wall Street, of course, the Yankees, the happening nightlife. But something that most people probably don't associate with NYC right away is religion. And yet, New York might very well be just as religious as parts of the Bible Belt, according to Azra Dawood. She's an architect, historian, and curator whose latest exhibit is called City of Faith. It's on display at the Museum of the City of New York and aims to highlight an often overlooked aspect of the Big Apple. The exhibit features a multimedia experience with a deeper look at the history of sacred space in a city that's often seen as very secular.
The city fathers, quote unquote, favored Protestantism. Later, when Catholic and Jewish communities arrived, sort of grew in numbers, they too had to make space for themselves, so they too had to struggle. It's a very well-documented struggle for both communities. So I think what we're seeing in the history of the city is a series of communities arriving or growing in number, right? Because if you think about Muslims have been in New York for hundreds of years, right? But thinking about, how communities make space for themselves.
Making that space hasn't been easy. For example, South Asian communities in New York after 9/11 had to deal with police surveillance, racial profiling, and hate crimes against Muslims. That includes attacks against those perceived to be Muslim, such as Sikhs and Hindus.
I think it's really poignant to look at this part of New York City.
That's Columbia University student Shelley Yu. She's visiting the museum exhibit.
Like, for example, the one behind you with the poetry about this person being pushed off the subway tracks. I had never, known of this incident before, and to hear it, being explained so, poignantly, it was, very touching and, very sobering to hear.
Yu was referring to the 2012 murder of Sunando Sen. He was a Hindu immigrant from India who was pushed in front of an oncoming subway train. The story is conveyed through a video presentation. But the very first thing that greets visitors to the exhibit isn't audio-visual at all. It's a sweet fusion of fragrances, ones that you might recognize if you've ever walked into a mosque. The combination of musk, frankincense, sandalwood, and rose is part of an installation by the Brooklyn-based perfumer and author Tanias. Another interactive display is a set of bright red folders mounted on the wall. Each one has a phrase written on top that's connected to the 9/11 aftermath, such as blanket surveillance, repercussions, or history repeating. The files inside are there for visitors to pick up and read through themselves. Gray Backwin, an architecture student from Barnard College, attended a panel discussion that highlighted the themes of the exhibit.
Being part of a marginalized identity means that you are inherently, your body becomes political in and of itself, and that makes you have, a heightened visibility, and then at the same time being pushed and peripheralized means that there's less visibility. I think it's incredibly important, for the history of the city, to be talked about and discussed and, displayed.
The City of Faith exhibition includes a range of religious immigrant experiences. There's a map of Jewish heritage sites and institutions across the city, along with an image of a 19th century Catholic school. To this day, there are many churches nestled throughout New York. The towering St. Patrick's Cathedral, right in the heart of Midtown Manhattan, might be the most famous one. A big contributor to the city's religious architecture was the philanthropist John D. Rockefeller. Curator Ezra Dawood points out, people probably don't know that the iconic Rockefeller Center at one point was supposed to include religious space.
There was a chapel planned for the very top of the building, and the chapel was not built with this idea that there's a chapel right at the top of this like real estate venture. Is very interesting.
Ezra Dawood's work has taken her back and forth across continents. She earned a PhD at MIT and spent a year teaching architecture at the University of Houston. She also taught in her hometown of Karachi, where she worked with Pakistan's first female architect. Describing that experience, Dawood says,
you develop a connection with the city and you learn it in a way. You learn more about it in a way than you would if you simply grew up there.
And seeing things from different perspectives is a key message that Ezra Dawood is trying to convey through the City of Faith exhibit at the Museum of the City of New York. For The World, I'm Sara Hassan.
If you can't make it to the Museum of the City of New York yourself anytime soon, don't worry. You can get a look at the City of Faith exhibit on our website. We are at theworld.org. At this year's World Economic Forum meeting in Davos, Switzerland, the word polycrisis is getting thrown around a lot. What's it mean? Well, poly is, of course, the Greek prefix for many, crisis, you know. In his opening remarks ahead of the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab ran down the list of problems in today's poly crisis.
Climate change, exploitation of nature, nuclear, possible incidents, or even wars.
Carl Matheson has been following the gathering of the powerful and wealthy from his base in Brussels. He's a senior climate correspondent with Politico Europe. So, Carl, the World Economic Forum is starting a new initiative to raise $3 trillion to combat climate change. $3 trillion. I mean, global climate conferences, typically countries pledge a couple of billion at a time at most. What does that tell us about the relative potential of private funding as compared to money from governments for climate?
The key word actually is mobilize $3 trillion. Everyone's trying to come up with the answer to how do you change the entire global economy. And the answer is it's going to take a lot of money, public funds, private funds, and philanthropic money. So only about 2% of philanthropic money at the moment goes towards climate change. So they're trying to guide philanthropies and give them avenues to put their money alongside the governments of the world and the companies of the world.
So the annual Davos event is famous for its powerful and wealthy attendees. Among the financial heavyweights at the event, climate investments has been a big talking point. What is pushing this now at Davos? And as you talk about mobilization to act, is it action or is it talk? Because we hear a lot about goals and pledges.
Yeah, I think that the world has truly woken up to this issue, and the World Economic Forum, and being, I guess, the most prominent face of global capitalism, is trying to reinvent capitalism in a way that doesn't mean that we see these negative outcomes constantly. And it's a messy process. Among the most powerful companies and people in the world are the CEOs and executives from fossil fuel companies, of which I think there's at least 27 fossil fuel CEOs. So the messiness of all of this is on show. The money that you're asking about, is it moving? It is. It's just not moving rapidly enough.
So today, Greta Thunberg spoke. She said a lot of people at Davos are helping to fund oil and gas projects that are fueling climate change.
They are prioritizing greed, corporate greed, and short-term economic profits above people and above planet.
How do people in the room in Davos react to this kind of frank talk?
Uncomfortably, I would imagine, because she's right. A lot of the world's largest and most prominent banks and asset managers, many of them have signed up to net zero aligned pledges and have sort of won the public kudos for doing that, are actually still plowing billions, even hundreds of billions, into the companies that are driving climate change.
So bottom line, Carl, what will it take, aside from taking a few things off the polycrisis list, for influential people at Davos to put the brakes on climate change?
I think that one of the most exciting things that's being proposed at the moment is this reordering of the global financial institutions, because they hold the levers within their business model. So this is the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund. Countries all around the world are thinking about this and thinking about how these institutions, which do control many, many billions in public funds, can work alongside the philanthropists and the investors in the world to release these trillions. And that's really where the big jumpstart, game-changing ideas are really coming from. And Davos could jump on this and take it forward.
Carl Matheson is a senior climate correspondent at Political Europe, speaking with us about how attendees at the Davos conference are thinking about climate change. He joined us from Brussels. Carl, good to speak with you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Marco.
Colombian pop superstar Shakira's collaboration with Argentine producer Bizarrap is topping the music charts this week. The new release doesn't even really have a name. It's just called Bizarrap Music Sessions No. 53. It's a bitter diss track blasting Shakira's ex, Spanish soccer player Gerard Piqué, for cheating on her. From Barcelona, Shakira's home for the past decade, reporter Alain Ruiz Terol has the deal on the diss.
Shakira is certainly not the first artist to make a diss song to settle scores with an ex, but she's elevating the genre to new heights. I was out of your league, that's why you're with someone who's just like you, Shakira sings. This is for you to be mortified. And if there are any doubts as to who she's talking to, women no longer cry, she sings. Women get paid. Shakira blasts the father of her two sons for leaving her for a younger woman, saying he traded a Rolex for a Casio. Yeray Sánchez Iborra is a journalist and a culture critic. We'd never seen Shakira write like this, he says, lyrics coming out as a spontaneous rant. Shakira said it's been cathartic, debuting at number one while singing in Spanish, especially at the age of 45. Para amarte, necesito una razón. Shakira began recording as a teenager in the 1990s. Journalist Nuria Net was growing up in Puerto Rico at the time.
She was a revelation across all Latin America, a young woman speaking about heartbreak and about love and about her aspirations and dreams, so that was super refreshing.
Then the singer-songwriter turned into a pop star.
Shakira, Shakira.
Oh, baby, when you talk like that, you make a woman go mad.
Singing in both English and Spanish, and with her unique dance moves inspired by her Arab roots, Shakira became one of the defining figures of a globalized music market.
She's been the biggest female Latina star in music in the past 30 years. There hasn't been another figure like her since, I think.
When she moved to Barcelona a decade ago and formed a family, she says her career was put on the back burner. But amid heartbreak, she's catching up again. Te felicito que bien actúas. Eso no me cabe duda. She's released three hits in a row, the latest being the Bizarrap session. They're all breakup songs in collaboration with younger Latin artists. Nuria Net says Shakira hasn't been this openly vulnerable for a long time.
It does remind me back to her beginnings when she was a singer-songwriter, a teenager, writing songs with her guitar, in a way.
Shakira has a new album coming out, which she thought was done, but keeps getting into the studio, making new music, because right now, she says, she feels creative. For The World, I'm Alan Ruiz Terol in Barcelona.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow.